Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a college professor tells us racist threats are limiting free speech on campus and they're a bigger problem than political correctness. First, the U.S. Senate could loosen banking restrictions that were put in place following the housing market collapse back in 2008. The Dodd-Frank Act was seen as landmark legislation and an effort to prevent an event like the Great Recession from happening again. But Republicans and some moderate Democrats are working to loosen regulations, while Democrats on the progressive wing of the party say consumers could be put at risk. Victoria Guida is a financial services reporter covering banking regulations and monetary policy for Politico Pro. Victoria, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Victoria, what changes if this Senate bill passes and is accepted by the House?
Yeah, so the first thing to know about this bill is that it does actually leave the vast majority of Dodd-Frank in place. But that's not to say that it doesn't do things that are significant. The biggest thing that it would do is there's currently an asset threshold where, banks of a certain size, if they're bigger than that, they face stricter regulation. That's currently set at $50 billion in assets. And there are only about 34, 35 banks that are above that threshold. And they're going to raise it to $250 billion. So that's going to only leave sort of the really big guys, a couple dozen banks that are still have, it's even less than that. So only the very biggest guys will now have this strict regulation. So that's sort of the most important thing that this bill would do.
Yeah, in a nutshell, for those banks that are no longer covered by that threshold, what's happening to them now that wouldn't happen anymore?
So there is something called stress tests, which is basically where the regulators say, hey, we want you to run a hypothetical scenario where, if things in the economy got really bad, what would happen to your bank? Would you be able to weather it? That's currently every year that the biggest banks have to do that. And now only the banks from $250 billion and above would necessarily have to do it every single year, whereas, some of those other banks would only have to do it periodically, which hasn't really been defined yet, but that's how it is in the legislation.
I want to give a listen to President Trump. He's been calling for loosening regulations across a number of sectors, including here, banking. And here he is earlier this year talking about why he thought Congress should roll back at least parts of Dodd-Frank.
We have to free up so the banks can loan money to great people, because the banks haven't been able to do that. They were restricted. A person came up to me at a recent stop and said, all my life I did business with a certain bank, and now all of a sudden they can't do business with me. I've always paid my debts. I've always paid my loans. The bank loves me, but they're prohibited from doing. Now they're going to be able to do business with that person again. So we're doing a real job on it.
So are banks unable to loan the way they once did to the extent that it's hurting the economy?
Well, that's a complex question, but I will say that one of the main purposes of this bill is to roll back regulation on community banks. And community banks say that Dodd-Frank has sort of weighed them down with all this paperwork and compliance burden, and so they can't, lend because it's just, or lend as much as they would want because, they're just subject to all of this paperwork. So that is definitely one of the major arguments from community banks. I mean, one of the tricky things about answering that question is what is the proper level of lending, since, a lot of people would argue that the amount of lending that went on right before the financial crisis probably wasn't a healthy level either. So it's sort of a complicated question to answer.
Right. Is that kind of the goal of Dodd-Frank, to say, okay, banks, do less risky, fancy stuff, be boring again, and make sure you have assets to cover the liabilities that you put out there in the form of loans? Is that the main outline of Dodd-Frank?
Sort of. I mean, it's definitely be less risky. I think it's sort of still wants to leave room for banks to be able to take some risk, since that's supposed to be involved in, growing the economy. Is, you take a risk on a small business or you take a risk on a, low creditworthy borrower. But yes, definitely saying, if you are going to take risks, make sure that you have, this capital and cash cushions, that if something goes wrong, you can absorb it.
Talking to Victoria Guida from Politico Pro, talking about possible changes to banking regulations, a rollback of parts of the Dodd-Frank legislation. This is going on now in the Senate. And Victoria, let's talk about the politics of this a little bit. This is supported apparently by a lot of Republicans and a significant number of Democrats, enough to actually pass this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are 12 Democratic senators and an independent, Angus King, which brings it presumably above the 60-vote threshold. I mean, they could lose, you know, a couple of Republicans, but they seem to have somewhat of a, you know, a cushion there. So they seem to be above the 60-vote threshold, which is pretty significant because, as I'm sure you know, not much really these days gets at least 60 votes in the Senate. So it's kind of a big deal.
But there's some bad blood among Senate Democrats now. Some of the more progressive members of the party in the Senate, often people who are on a list of people who might run for president, say in a couple of years, they're unhappy about these changes. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown, who is the top Democrat on the Senate Banking Committee, are both very much against this bill. They say that it would, loosen protections on consumers. They're worried about, what I was talking about earlier of sort of narrowing the scope of banks that are subject to these really tough rules. And so they have been going all out fighting against this bill, despite the fact that some of their fellow party members are in support of this. And a lot of the Democrats that support this are Democrats that are in red states. You know, being able to say, you know, I'm helping my community bank or my regional bank, and I'm working with, you know, the Republicans on something. It's sort of, you know, it's a good argument for them. Whereas, you know, it's also on the progressive Democratic side a pretty easy argument to say, well, you know, the banks did just blow up the economy 10 years ago, and so do we really want to be rolling back rules on banks? So it's a pretty intense war within Democrats. Within the Democratic Party.
Now, this is all what's going on in Congress. I understand, and I think you wrote about this a little, that the president and his administration have some power to change things, and they're changing the way they regulate banks. What are they doing?
Right. So the way that banks are regulated, there are three federal bank regulators, and they're actually, they're all independent, but Trump has nominated and the Senate has confirmed people to lead almost all of those regulatory efforts. The FDIC chair is still pending before the Senate, but she'll be confirmed. And so these are sort of Trump-appointed people who can, you know, simplify some of these rules. I mean, the people that he has in there are largely sort of more moderate Republicans. He does have the acting director of the CFPB is a guy named Mick Mulvaney, who the CFPB is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And he's sort of making some radical changes at the agency, but some of the other, bank regulators are being a little bit more mild in how they're approaching changes.
Now, we've talked about the Senate. We've talked about the White House. What's going on in the House? I understand they have their own version of a partial repeal of Dodd-Frank. What's going on over there?
Yes. So the House passed a bill called the Financial Choice Act, which would have been a much more significant repeal and replace of Dodd-Frank. It wouldn't have repealed all of Dodd-Frank, but it would have repealed a lot of really major pieces of it, whereas, you know, the Senate bill can only be seen as sort of taking, you know, little tiny pieces of it. So it is a question mark of, you know, once this bill passes the Senate, whether the House is going to accept it. And so what's going on right now is there's actually negotiations with the House sort of before it gets its final vote in the Senate so that, you know, potentially something can pass the Senate and then be able to just pass the House without any changes so that there doesn't have to be a conference or it doesn't have to go back to the Senate.
And that's what we'll watch for next. Victoria, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
Victoria Guida is a financial services reporter covering banking regulations and monetary policy for Politico Pro. She was with us to talk about a Senate plan to roll back banking regulations. Right now, college campuses are often criticized for promoting political correctness, choosing words or policies so as not to offend groups of people, or providing unfriendly climates for particular perspectives. A writer in the National Review last month said political correctness is, quote, oozing out of campuses, stifling democracy, and, quote, creating a less free, less civil, less tolerant society. Our next guest says there's a bigger problem on college campuses: racist threats and harassment directed at faculty, especially at women and people of color. Trissy McMillan Cottom is an author and assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. Trissy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, you wrote in a recent piece about your own and other people's experiences with harassment and threats, and you say it often follows a common thread. Can you talk through what's happened to you and your colleagues?
Sure. So we are now maybe in the third or fourth year where I think a couple of things have converged for those of us who teach and do research for a living in the, you know, in the American university. So the first is, you know, there's just been a change, I think, in the overall political discourse. You know, some of that driven by partisanship, sort of extreme partisanship, perhaps. People sense that they cannot have sort of a direct effect on their political climate. So I think people are feeling very disaffected. At the same time, we have seen over the last 40 years the face of the academy change significantly. So people get sort of this this idea, somewhat true, maybe not as true as people would like to believe, that professors have become, it's less common for us to see the professoriate as being overwhelmingly white or male. And so that diversification of the American academy has happened. And then the other thing that was that has been happening over the past few years is that technology has just made it increasingly efficient to target, identify, and coordinate a response to or an attack on professors that people may not think are doing the job the way they would like for them to do it. When all of those things come together, we see what has been, over the last 3 or 4 years, a sort of perfect storm for sort of putting academics out there in the public to encourage the public's trust in us at the very time when overall public trust in our social institutions like government and education tend to be declining or at least pulling apart by political ideology, oftentimes with conservatives having less trust in things like educational institutions than do people who identify as liberals or progressives. With all of that happening, the perfect storm has made it so that many academics, and not all academics the same way, have experienced some of the things that I experienced, either directly or through supporting some of my colleagues. And that looks like doing what your university asks you to do, so to engage with publics, to try to work with your students, to give them a public audience. You might teach a course online, for example, or put some of your reading material on the internet. What can happen next, especially when you're teaching things that are not common for people to experience in their daily life? So that's things like gender or race or class or sort of these really nuanced conversations about inequality broadly. When those things are opened up online, where people may not have either the right or the most honest interpretation of the work that you do, there's now an entire machine set up to target you for harassment and elevation in the public sphere in ways that academics can't respond to.
And Trissy, talk about the form that that takes. What starts happening to you or your colleagues? What are the first signs that this storm is coming your way?
One of the first things that happen is if you are engaging in public scholarship at all and say you have a university contact, right, who has your contact information to offer you up as an expert to speak to the public, they start to become deluged with emails, right? Or your university social media accounts will start to become overwhelmed with responses on Facebook that looks like tons of Facebook comments, on Twitter that looks like many Twitter responses and resharing of your comments on Twitter and other platforms. So that's your first immediate hit, right? You just start to see an uptick in kind of traffic. And then the type of traffic, the things that they're saying, right? They tend to be, I think most people would be surprised by how coarse and violent some of those comments and responses can be. You can see everything from, you know, just a critique of your work to a direct attack on who you are as a person to outright violent threats of harm against you and your family. So those comments start to roll in. The second wave is almost always with email and then phone calls to your office or your administrative office. So it's the idea of instilling fear in people. That tactic is old hat, right, to make people afraid. What is different is how large the response can feel, especially to a university culture where getting a few emails is considered excessive. When you're talking about hundreds, and in some cases for some of my colleagues, thousands of emails and phone calls being directed into your university, it's overwhelming, which, of course, is the point. The next step that a lot of my colleagues are experiencing, including myself, I get a lot of mail, you know, just old-fashioned postal mail. So handwritten notes, some containing threats, some just criticism. So I want to be fair that these are different categories. But some of them outright threats, and so they also come through the mail system. Perhaps the most troubling third or fourth tier effect for some of the most public of these events is when those entities, internet people, these organizations and groups, are able to get politicians and your administration to take their claims seriously. So in some cases, that looks like, you know, partisan politicians in the state, you know, reaching out to the leader of your university to say, hey, what's up with that professor? What are they doing? And that can feel like a very implicit threat on your job security.
We're talking about racist threats targeting university professors. Tressie McMillan-Cottom is with us from Virginia Commonwealth University. Tressie, actual threats of violence. I mean, do you and your colleagues, I mean, do you get to the point mm-hmm. where you fear for your safety?
Yes, you know, I sat down with my department chair just a week ago for our annual sit down with the chief of police, right? And I mean, I'm a professor, for goodness sake, right? I didn't sign up for combat here, but we have regular meetings to sit down and talk about whether or not my office is secure, how we're going to handle the processing of my mail, and those kinds of things. So it is enough of a threat that you can perceive that there's a pattern. And here's the thing about death threats. Certainly people toss them off, and almost always they're just figurative, right? Almost no one needs to actually come and kill you. The problem is you can't tell the figurative death threats from the literal death threats, right? And so this is what we see again about sort of that distillation and diffusion of fear, because there really isn't a reasonable way to handle death threats except to take them all seriously. When you realize that there are strangers out there who are willing or able to at least casually discuss killing you or harming you or your family, it absolutely changes how you can do your work and how you go about doing your job. It makes you extremely paranoid and uncomfortable, you know, just navigating the space of your campus. Most of our campuses are open for that reason, that we want people to feel welcome there. Well, when you are on an open campus and feeling like you're living under the cloud of threat, that openness can make you feel very insecure.
Does this make some professors not want to speak freely in public, just keep their heads down and do the job?
I think absolutely, and I think that's absolutely the point, right? One of the reasons why groups, not all of them even U.S.-based, I mean, this is all part of the same machinery that we saw at play during our most recent presidential election. You know, this is all part of this now ecosystem of building the perception of threat and fear. And so that's certainly the point, to make people too afraid to engage with the public. And here's the catch-22 for academics. More than almost any time in recent memory, we need now academics and professors to be in public telling people what we do, telling them what service we provide to the public, and to the body politic. This is the exact wrong time for us to be too afraid to have those conversations with the people and the communities that we serve. But I think it's absolutely reasonable when individuals say, listen, the individual cost and burden, especially to my family, might be too high for me to be engaging with the public. And we all lose when that happens.
This is a global problem, an internet-wide problem. Do you see mm-hmm. solutions?
So I'm a sociologist, so I always think about there's the big solutions, right, the big structural fixes, and then there are the things that people can do. And so ideally, I think both of those things have to happen. There's no way around the fact that we are, as a society, a democratic society, going to have to deal with how the internet has changed the way we communicate, right? So we're going to have to change the very systems that make it possible for people to target and threaten professors is the system that makes it possible for people to buy online ads, for example. It's the exact same system. So we're going to have to figure out that these things that we thought were really innocuous, you know, social media, are actually quite powerful and probably too powerful to not be legislated. So I'm in favor of government regulation, actually, for many of these platforms. Now, individually, I think some of the things that we're going to have to learn how to do in the new, you know, digital society and world we live in, we're going to have to become better consumers of the things that we read, news and information. You know, these things can be so slickly produced, the memes, the posts, that it can be very hard for you to tell what's true. But increasingly, we're going to have to know what's true because as a democratic population, we're going to have to weigh in on how these things are legislated. So we're going to have to become better consumers, teach our children to hold each other to a better standard of sharing information with each other.
A brief but complicated question, maybe. From where you're sitting now, do you see things trending to get better or to get worse when it comes to these threats?
Absent any of those other things that we just talked about happening, it is difficult to imagine things getting better by themselves, right? So without some political action, without individuals taking responsibility of how they use the internet, without universities doing more to protect their professors, our political discourse is simply at a place that we should probably expect this type of combative, you know, clash of ideas. But we can do things to mitigate the consequences of them. But without those things happen, I suspect we see things get much worse. It's much worse in other countries, for example. And so we know that that's possible. So I suspect that if we don't do anything, it will become a whole lot worse before it gets better.
Tressie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Tressie McMillan-Cottom. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She joined us to talk about racism on college campuses and threats and why she says that's a bigger threat than political correctness. First, according to a 2016 report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Wisconsin's rate of drug and opioid overdose deaths exceeds the national average. One Wisconsin organization is hoping to reduce opioid-related overdose deaths in the state by using recovery coaches. They train people who have experience with addiction and recovery to be peer advocates or recovery coaches for people who are experiencing addiction themselves. Caroline Miller is a director of Wisconsin Voices for Recovery. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
And Michael Kelly is with us, recovery coach for the organization. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Well, Caroline, tell us a little bit about the recovery coach program. How does it work?
Absolutely. So the recovery coach program is called ED2Recovery, and the ED stands for Emergency Department. So our organization, Wisconsin Voices for Recovery, which is actually a grant house at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and funded by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. This grant oversees the implementation of this statewide program. And so we contract with organizations all over the state. Right now we're working with 10 to implement ED2 recovery in over 14 different hospital settings. And so the recovery coach or peer support specialist will go into the emergency department after having after someone calls in after having had an opioid overdose. And they meet with that individual and their family members in most instances to talk with that person, provide emotional support, just connect with them and really be there to listen. Additionally, offering resources if that person is open to it at that point. And I want to highlight that a really amazing part of our ED2 recovery program is that the recovery coach or peer support specialist will actually follow that individual almost like a warm handoff into the community. And to spend time with them over a long period of time to continue to follow up to offer that support.
And Caroline, tell us who can be a recovery coach? Who goes into this and how do they get trained on this?
Well, a recovery coach is a person who has lived experience in recovery. So that could be either a person in recovery from a substance use disorder or addiction themselves, or it could also be a family member or someone else with that type of experience in recovery. And a recovery coach can be trained. There's a model for training called that's based out of Connecticut called the CCAR Recovery Coaching Training. And so all of our recovery coaches that are a part of ED2 Recovery have been trained with that recovery coaching model, which is amazing. It teaches people more about, you know, how to listen, reflective listening, how to be empathetic, also down to, you know, ethics and boundary considerations when you're talking about working with people who are struggling. So it's a great training, and we also have certified peer support specialists. And those individuals go through a training or curriculum that's certified by the state of Wisconsin. Again, that training, people in recovery from addiction themselves, from other mental health concerns, are able to then work with these individuals.
And Michael, let's bring you in here. You are a recovery coach yourself. I think you also train other recovery coaches. Can you tell us your story? What led you into this?
What led me into this? Well, I'm in recovery myself, as you said. I'm a recovering alcoholic. But what started was the Janesville Police Department started a program called DROP, which helped young people, first offenders type things, get their record cleared if they got into recovery. And four of us from down in the southern Wisconsin, Rock County area, kind of headed that up. And we got into helping these people and just kind of helped them along like the recovery coaches do now. Back then, there was no recovery coach program, but we kind of started our own. And from there, we thought, what best place to get a hold of the opioid problem people would, you know, to help them. We thought that the ER, or the ED department, when they first did the overdose, would be the ideal time, because that's when they're looking for the help. So we started that, and then the grant came along, and we just kind of continued into the grant.
And Michael, talk about what that conversation is like. There's somebody, they've been admitted to the emergency department after an overdose. This is huge. What is that first conversation like between you and the person in that emergency room?
I'll tell you, it's a pretty unique thing. It's the biggest thing we run into is the person will say, I didn't feel like I was alone anymore. Now, they could have 50 people around them, but police officers or doctors or nurses or anything else feel like they're by themselves. But when somebody that's been through an addiction and been through the recovery process sits down to talk to them, they're on the same level. You've got the lived experience that you've been there, and they can tell just by talking to you that you know what they're going through. You can connect right there. Then they've got something to hold on to. They've got a connection to somebody that really has made it. And it kind of gives them the hope they need to get out and get through the struggle.
We're talking to Michael Kelly and Caroline Miller. They're with Wisconsin Voices for Recovery. Caroline's the director. Caroline's the director there. Michael is a recovery coach. And Caroline, is that the key here, that the recovery coach is someone who's been through maybe not exactly the same thing, but something that at least puts them on that same wavelength, that even the most compassionate doctor or social worker or whatever might not have that connection?
Yes, you got it correctly. Hit the nail on the head there. It is absolutely correct. So when a person walks in, as Mike said, to the emergency department and they have that lived experience, they can say, you know, I've lived through an opioid overdose, or even, you know, I've lived through addiction and now I'm on the other side of that and am walking a journey of recovery. That gives an individual hope in a way that, you know, doctors and nurses who do amazing work, and, you know, we really commend the work that Wisconsin doctors and nurses and other medical providers are doing to address the opioid crisis and this issue. But peers can do that in a way that is totally unique. And, you know, if we think about it, if you're not a person in recovery, but you're struggling with something, does it not help to talk to someone who's been there, who's also experienced that? So it's not unique. I mean, really, when you boil it down, it's a really simple concept. And what's incredible, as Mike mentioned, you know, we have this grant now, which is amazing, but people in recovery have been doing this for decades for free. You know, people, this is a part of what recovery means. Recovery is not just about healing your own addiction. A part of being in recovery, and I'm in recovery myself, is to give that back, to pay that forward. And so those of us in recovery, it's healing for us to be able to share our experience and help others.
Mike, do you see this recovery coaching as part of your own recovery?
Oh, without a doubt. It's an old saying in the recovery world is the coach will get 10 times more than what they get back than what they give. Just because you're you have to go back through your own mind and look at your own recovery again. It keeps reminding you of the good things that have happened and how much better it is now. And you see the person that's struggling in recovery and that's really coming out of it and, you know, starting to do well. You see the hope and the growth, and it kind of reminds you and makes you feel the real recovery for yourself also.
Caroline, you mentioned you are in recovery yourself. I imagine that for someone in the depths of addiction, in the situation where they're in an emergency room, it's got to be hard to imagine anything else, right? A path to get from here to there, to recovery, and then having a coach there, well, that's an illustration. Somebody has walked through that. How much of it is just modeling, portraying that possible future path?
Absolutely. I mean, that's it. It's about hope and showing that there is a future path. So oftentimes, you know, we encourage our recovery coaches to go in and just listen. You know, listen when you go into that first meeting. It's not about offering advice or, you know, telling people what recovery path to take. It's about listening to their story. And generally, the recovery coach or the certified peer support specialist, just their physical presence offers that hope, because they see that this person is here, they're living, they're breathing, they've been through this. And so it's, you know, it's really incredible. And Mike has tons of stories of people whose lives have been changed by this program, but it's really incredible to see recovery work like this.
Mike, can you share a story of someone you've worked with?
I can share some generalizations.
Well, sure.
It's just awesome to watch people be reunited with their children. It's watching them be reunited with their families. For their families to see the turnaround, and for the person to see their own turnaround, to see their own growth, and they stand back and look at where they've come from. And you see that smile on their face, and that, you know, they always say that sparkle in their eye, but that is so true when you see somebody that's really making it, starting to get it. They found their own path to recovery.
We're talking to Caroline Miller and Michael Kelly. Caroline's director of Wisconsin Voices for Recovery. Michael is a recovery coach with that organization. They're part of this initiative to provide peer counseling for people who are going through addiction, people recovering from an overdose in an emergency department. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone close to you dealt with opioid addiction? Was there someone to talk to, someone like this who understood what addiction was like? Maybe it come out the other side. Have you been a coach like this yourself? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation about recovery coaching for people dealing with opioid addiction. Caroline Miller is with us, director of Wisconsin Voices for Recovery. Michael Kelly is with that organization. He's a recovery coach, someone who works with people one-on-one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has addiction affected your life personally or through someone you care about? What do you think about this idea of peer-to-peer coaching, bringing somebody who's in recovery together with somebody who wants to get there? And are you a healthcare worker who sees this firsthand? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Scott is with us in Eau Claire. Scott, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about, Scott?
My son had just passed a couple of years ago from an accidental heroin overdose. His girlfriend went after treatment after that. It really shook her up. We hadn't been in his life for years, but found out about this. And we kind of put her under our wing and helped her as much as we could, just dealing with a tragic loss of our son. So I just see what they're doing is an incredible thing. And these people do not want to be on this drug. It's taken over on them, and I think what they're doing is awesome. So I applaud them.
Scott, thank you for calling. I'm sorry for the loss of your son. Congratulations to his girlfriend on being in recovery. Caroline, in Wisconsin, we hear so many stories like this. Do you see your effort maybe turning the tide a little bit?
Well, first off, I want to say I reiterate that, Scott. I'm very sorry for your loss, and at the same time, feel a lot of hope with you. It sounds like your son's past girlfriend is doing well now in recovery, and good for you all for being there for her. I think a lot of times stigma gets in the way of people supporting those seeking recovery, and it's not a moral failing or a choice. Addiction is a medical condition, and so, you know, getting help and getting treatment is a positive thing, and it definitely works for people. Recovery works. So I certainly hope that what we're doing is turning the tide. And as Mike mentioned, we have so many stories of people's lives being changed by ED2 recovery, and certainly so many more stories about people in Wisconsin, those voices of recovery that have had, you know, transforming experiences and just new lives because of their journey with peer support and with recovery coaching. People who are now, you know, employed in the workforce, and people who have healed relationships with their families and friends and loved ones, who are assets to their community. So, yes.
Mike, Caroline mentioned the stigma here, and do you see maybe that person again who's had an overdose, gone to the emergency room for it, being ashamed to talk about it, feeling like they were judged, but then maybe being more willing to open up to someone who has their own story about addiction?
Oh, without a doubt. When you can talk to somebody being on the same level and being empathetic because you've been there and you understand it, they're going to talk to you because they have the shame, but they know that you've been there and you can understand that it's not something that you can, you know, it's not self-will. It's actually is a disease. It's something that they can battle. It's something that can be won. And a lot of people don't understand that. But no, they definitely feel a lot better talking to somebody that's been there because they know that it can be a battle, can be won.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Kate is with us in Appleton. Kate, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I have a niece that's been fighting addiction for probably, you know, 5 years now. And, you know, we've encouraged her to go to treatments and different things of that nature, but this is the first time I've heard of this recovery coach and through the emergency department. Is that something that's offered throughout the state of Wisconsin or just in certain areas?
Kate, thanks for the call. Caroline, let's throw this to you. If someone's out there, not necessarily in the emergency room, but can they connect and work with a recovery coach?
Absolutely. So if there's a way that we can connect offline, Kate, I would love to do that. We actually have a statewide network of not only recovery coaches, but also recovery community organizations that themselves either have recovery coaches or just are, you know, have volunteers, people in recovery that would be more than happy to support your niece or connect with you to, you know, share some resources and things like that. So there's a lot going on in terms of recovery support, especially in the Appleton area. So I'd love to connect with you offline.
Kate, we're putting you on hold. I've asked our producer to, if you're willing, share your contact information that we'll pass on to Caroline after the show. Good luck to you and your niece, Kate. Thank you so much for calling in. We are talking about recovery coaches for people dealing with opioid addiction. We have Caroline Miller with us, director of Wisconsin Voices for Recovery, and Michael Kelly. He's a recovery coach. Caroline, can you mentioned this is you're working with 10 organizations around Wisconsin. Are you looking to expand that now into more communities?
Yes, absolutely. We are definitely looking to expand. And actually, this next grant year, which our grant year starts May 1st, we're hoping to be in at least, you know, 5 to 10 more different counties across the state. Currently, we're working with 10 organizations in 12 counties within 14 hospitals. So we do have, you know, it's a very large program, but we are hoping to get in as many counties in the state of Wisconsin as we can.
Mike, if there are people in recovery out there who would like to get involved in being a recovery coach, what would you say to them? How would you encourage them to do something like this?
I would say it's a path down your own path and your own path to recovery that is just, it's amazing. Get in touch with somebody in some the organizations in the counties that are applying for the grants or get the grants to do this. And even if you can't get a grant, you know what it's like to be out there. And there's people out there that are looking for help. So just be available to those people. And it's a gift that it's amazing. And it works both ways that way.
And Mike, you've been doing this for some time now in Rock County. Have you had people you've worked with who showed up in the emergency room? They worked with you, they went through recovery, they're going through recovery, and they're they're recovery coaches themselves now?
Actually, I've got probably the first young lady I worked with just finished her master's in, trying to think of what they call it, but it's recovery. It's recovery oriented, and so she's come a long ways, you know. So she's working on that end of it.
I got to ask, Mike. This isn't a parent situation, but you got to feel something like a proud parent when you see that happen, right?
It's amazing. It really is. You do feel like a proud parent, you know. It's just to watch that growth over the years, and you know, it's only been like 4 years, but to see what they go through in the beginning and just watch how much they grow. It's like watching them go to graduation. You're absolutely right.
And Caroline, recovery coaches can be part of the process. Do you also help connect people with other services that they're going to need to get through recovery?
Absolutely. So one of the pieces of our grant, which is very innovative and new in terms of this ED program, is all of our organizations that work with us are creating a recovery resource map. So not only do recovery coaches go in to provide that peer support, but they also have a tangible list of resources and what's available in different communities, so they're able to share that information. And Wisconsin Voices for Recovery, more generally, we are always available. You can find us online at wisconsinvoicesforrecovery.org. We have a phone number up, email. You can contact us anytime, and we are all about connecting individuals who are either seeking treatment or seeking help or that doing that for their loved one. We want to connect people with the resources that are out there in Wisconsin, and there are many. I think a lot of times we hear about the negatives and, you know, and what we don't have. Wisconsin is filled with recovery assets and has so many strengths in terms of the types of recovery support that's available.
Caroline, Mike made the case for people in recovery to get on board as coaches. Are there places around the state that you know of, Caroline, that you really have the help wanted sign out for recovery coaches?
That's a great question. I hope we're moving more into that area, in that direction, because recovery coaches and peer support specialists can be such an asset to so many different areas of life, so not just recovery organizations, but businesses, treatment providers, so many different areas, hospitals themselves. So I would encourage, you know, all of us to keep thinking about how we can include recovery coaches or peer support specialists into our businesses and organizations. And you're feel free to contact Wisconsin Voices for Recovery to talk more about what that could look like. But right now, you know, recovery coaches and peer support specialists are certainly in demand, but I think we need to keep having that conversation of what that can continue to look like and how we can grow that demand.
And Mike, in our last few moments, we've seen a lot of bad news on opioids in Wisconsin, but I'm hearing a lot of hope from you guys. Are you seeing a point where we as a state are going to be in recovery and start to turn the tide on this problem?
I can honestly see the tide turning right now, just with all the attention that this is getting and with the recovery coaches and seeing how this is growing, how this recovery coach program is growing and just how it is affecting people. Because like you'd asked me earlier, have I seen it passed on? I could see it passed on right now for people that have been through the ED end of it are asking how they can become recovery coaches and how they can do it because it affected them so much. And it's going to be like a spider web, just spidering out, you know, among people trying to help each other.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to both of you for joining us. Michael Kelly is a recovery coach. Caroline Miller is the director for Wisconsin Voices for Recovery. They've been talking about the recovery coach program that trains individuals with experience with addiction and recovery to be peer advocates to help out people experiencing addiction right now. A new scientific project may have created the snack of the future, as reported at bakeryandsnacks.com, which is a thing. It's a nutritious, sustainable treat made from an abundant natural resource. Sound good? Also, it's jellyfish chips. Producer Chris Molina is our go-to weird snack guy. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Rob.
You're salivating at the concept of jellyfish chips.
I think you put anything in chip form, and I'm going to be excited about it. It sounds like researchers from Denmark have come up with a way to make jellyfish dry and crunchy.
Crispy.
Crispy, yeah. And it's, I mean, they're going to be essentially potato chips, except they're going to be jellyfish chips. So, I mean, why not? You know me,
You'll try anything.
I will try anything. Currently, I'm working my way through all the different flavors of kettle chips right now.
Oh.
And they've gotten increasingly more bizarre. So just, I mean, throw jellyfish chips onto the list. Why not?
Yeah, so apparently marinated jellyfish is big in a lot of Asian cultures.
It's a thing.
But Westerners find them kind of slimy and flavorless. So get some crunch to them.
I think that's it. I think if you like deep fry anything and give that like a little crunch, I think that's how you introduce foods that we don't normally have in our culture. That's how you really introduce it to us.
And I understand. I think it was in Shedd Aquarium. I saw like jellyfish. They're taking over and disrupting ecosystems. So two jellyfish with one stone here.
It's a win-win. You clean up some ecosystems and you snack on something.
Some delicious jellyfish. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.